Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Finance Committee to order. Today is Thursday, October 29, 2015. The time is 12:37 p.m. Members present are Representative Wilson, Guerra, Pruitt, Kawasaki, Vice Chair Sadler, Co-Chair Thompson, myself, Representative Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Gaddis, Edgman, and Munoz. We do have a full house today. Thank you.
Quick point of order, Mr. Chair. It's 1:37 versus 12:37. Some of our clocks aren't correct in here. So just a point of order for the record.
Yeah, they are. We're both there.
I believe the time right now is about 1:37. Somewhere in the neighborhood.
And, Mr. Chair, you said 12:37, and I was giving you cover that maybe our clocks aren't correct. Thanks, colleagues.
That's a hint that daylight savings time is getting added to the call.
So today we're going to continue our hearings on the proposal on the TransCanada buyout proposal, the termination with TransCanada. I'd like to invite our consultants up from Analytica, Janik Mayer. Janik? And Nico Stofos, did I say that right?
Close enough. Stofos.
Hey, you, guy on the left. Come to the table and begin their presentation. So, otherwise known as Analytica. Gentlemen? And then we'll go through the program again as we usually do, and then we'll do questions at the end.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer. I'm chairman of Analytica. By now, I'm a familiar face. This is my fourth year sitting at this table advising on oil and gas issues, both sort of issues around oil and gas economics, fiscal issues, and for the last several years, questions of natural gas commercialization and the project to commercialize the North Slope reserves.
For the record, my name is Nico Stofos, president of Analytica. My background is really natural gas commercialization strategy and project development, and this is my third year advising the state legislature on topics relating to North Slope natural gas. I'll go and give it back to Janik, and then you'll hear from me pretty soon.
We have been here from the outset of this special session, sitting in on every committee hearing both here and in the Senate to come to terms with the full range of the case and the testimony on various different fronts put before both bodies. We have produced, at the start of the session, we circulated an extensive report on giving our take on what we thought the key issues here were. That goes into a lot of detail, we think. Here we wanted to step back and, having heard everything from the last week, sort of summarize our view of things in what we see as our role as essentially sort of performing a degree of due diligence for the legislature on some of the things that are presented. We wanted to start by just going back to January 2014, where we had a long session devoted in large part, a lot of debate around SB 138 and everything that was put to the legislature then, the heads of agreement, the memorandum of understanding, the enabling legislation that was SB 138. And throughout that whole time, perhaps the single most contentious aspect of what was brought before the legislature and proposed then was TransCanada's participation in this project. And there was both impassioned and at times compelling argument put forward by the administration on why that was beneficial for the state, as well as a degree of scrutiny and skepticism from the legislature about some of that. And we wanted to step back and think about both what the case was back then and what the skepticism was back then, and sort of use that to frame where we think we now are and what we think of the arguments that have been put forward in front of this committee. So back then, the Parnell administration came and presented the heads of agreement, the memorandum of understanding, SB 138, and made a particular case for why TransCanada's participation in this project was important. And that was built on a number of key pillars. One was the experience that the TransCanada brought to this project as a company that had a very long history of working on gas pipelines, specifically in Alaska, most recently obviously through AGEA, and experience in general with Northern Pipelines. In particular, there was a very strong argument about the importance of continuity and momentum, right? That through the AGEA process, a lot of work had been done, a lot of data generated, a lot of work product generated, and along with that, the various parties involved in this sort of transition from AGEA were playing well, and it was going to be really important to both make sure that all that work product and all that data was captured and properly brought over to AKLNG, and that the AGEA partnership should be able to be dissolved cooperatively and amicably rather than in dispute, and that to the extent that there were questions of damages under the AGEA contract, that all these could be settled amicably by going this route rather than miring everything down in conflict and questioning the continuity that would happen. On the governance front, there was a strong argument put forward that said, you know, actually, from the administration's perspective, they had really appreciated the participation of a company that made money by moving molecules, that was fundamentally interested in moving gas rather than commercializing particular reserves, as a company that was looking to future expansion possibilities. And that having, you know, a company like that at the table negotiating terms had already helped them in what they were able to negotiate on expansion, for instance, and that they could see a serious role for a company like this in making sure that at the negotiating table, negotiating all of these commercial terms and doing all of the detailed technical work that would go forward, that commercial case for making sure expansion was a priority because it was a priority of the state, and that the state's interest wasn't necessarily just monetizing the existing resources at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, that would be a significant help for the state on that front. So that governance question obviously flows over into our point on expansion, that TC not only would help in the governance agreements to make that entire arrangement possible, but that in a post-project construction and operation world, where this project actually existed, but you know, when new discoveries were found, when there was potential new gas to bring into the project, that there would be a commercially minded partner here capable of going out and figuring out the commercial case for what could be commercialized, what couldn't, how you would get gas into the pipe, how you would, you know, commercialize and finance expansion, how all of this would work. On execution, the argument was that TC's experience would potentially make a successful project more likely. And finally, the argument was put, and I think of all of those arguments at the time, this was the one that we certainly, in listening to these arguments, were most skeptical of, was the idea that it would provide fundamental help, not in terms of cost of capital to the state. I think there was a lot of recognition even then that, you know, compared to potential cost of capital to the state through debt, that this was could at least be expensive, but the idea was put forward that it would help with the state's overall debt capacity, right? That the state had limited ability to borrow and that this was going to help. And I think that was something that at the time and ever since we have said is probably the element that one needed to question most about that case. That was the case that was put to the legislature in 2014, and I think the legislature quite rightly had some particular skepticism about particular points. There was a question, of course, as to, you know, the tariff cost and whether that was competitive, both in terms of looking at market rates and norms and what other pipelines charge, but in particular in terms of how that might compare to the state's cost of debt. And, you know, one of the logical endpoints of that discussion, of that skepticism, was putting in place in SB 138 a requirement that the administration come back, and of course at the time it was viewed that, you know, a whole bunch of agreements would be coming back all at once, and that these would come back at once and there would be an extensive report as part of that on the financing options and how the various financing options for the state compared, to enable that comparison to be made as to how competitive or not competitive in terms of the cost of debt this was. On the risk-reward front, I think there was particularly a lot of concern that there were some ways in which it seemed like this might be a slightly one-sided arrangement, in particular that TransCanada earned an equity rate of return on their participation in the project, but that when one looked at most of the sort of markers of, you know, that equity one traditionally thinks of as implying ownership risk, that almost all of the equity risk remained with the state. That if there was an increase in the capital requirement of the project, it was more expensive during construction, that would simply pass on to the state through the tariff that was then ultimately charged to the state for recovery. If TC wasn't able to arrange financing for the project, TC could simply walk away at any point and be reimbursed with interest. That on almost any aspect of risk that one might consider, that the risk profile of TransCanada's participation in this looked a lot more like the risk profile of debt than the risk profile of equity. And I think, you know, there was a lot of discussion about this at the time and concern that, you know, because of the concern with continuity with the GU with all the rest, perhaps the state had signed up to an agreement that, that wasn't as equitable as it would like. In addition to the question of risk and reward, on that front, one of the key things that TransCanada obtained through that agreement was by fronting up the capital as TC's financier, they also effectively had the voting rights. As we've heard over the last several days within the project partnership, that there would be certain crucial things for which that the state would have right of veto over, including things like approval of the work plan and budget, but then on many other things, ultimately TransCanada would be free to make their own vote in their own interest, which may align perfectly with the state, but which might not. And finally, there was particularly a lot of discussion of this whole question of back-in rights, and we've heard this mentioned a few times in the last week, the idea of, okay, it seemed under the memorandum of understanding there were a range of circumstances in which the state could terminate this agreement, but it also seemed, and I remember vividly a conversation with one particular legislator who looked at this and said, well, I see all these things they call off-ramps, but they all seem to lead back to an on-ramp. And that was a reference to the fact that there was also a clause in the MOU saying, you know, yes, the state can terminate, but if any time it decides to proceed with this project or a similar project, it will offer TransCanada participation in that project on basically the same terms. And there was a lot of concern about that to say, okay, you've told us we need this for continuity and alignment, but we need more time to decide whether this is really where we want to go or not, and we need to make sure there is at least one solid off-ramp so that we can come back and revisit this whole question and decide whether or not this is ultimately in the state's interest. And because of that process of legislative review, of legislative scrutiny, the end result of that was to say that that specific term on a five-year back-in right to TransCanada would eventually be included in the firm transportation services agreement that was negotiated, but that it would not be included in the precedent agreement that was signed after SB 138 was enacted and that has governed the relationship with TransCanada from that point until now. This is, of course, the precedent agreement that was finally released for review by the legislature in the last few days. So because of that work of legislative scrutiny, in achieving that, we made the legislature in that sense made sure that there would be this one firm off-ramp of late 2015 to come back and review all this and decide whether or not this was truly in the state's interest. And that's where we are now, and this is the one off-ramp, the one chance to actually look at that and make that judgment.
For the record, Nikos Tsafos. We're moving on to slide 3 for those who are following online. I wanted to pause here for a sec before we go into the substantive part of our analysis and talk a little bit about how we've approached this question and how we've thought about our role in this special session. So when the call from the governor came, we started sort of piecing together our thoughts, the work culminating in the report that we released in the beginning of special session that I think most of you have had a chance to read. In doing that, we had a number of conversations with the administration and its consultants. With Black and Veatch, obviously, we have a very good working relationship since last year. During the discussions about SB 138, we were able to get some calls and meetings with them and able to talk through their assumptions. We didn't try to recreate a model where we started getting different numbers and we have to argue why do you get 32.5 and I get 32.2. We didn't do that because there wasn't really time for that in a one-month call. But we had a good chance to look at their assumptions, and we were fairly familiar with their methodology based on the economics that we did they did last year. So we had a number of conversations with Black & Veatch. We had the opportunity to talk to the state's financial advisors, chiefly Greengate and First Southwest. We were able to get some good discussions going with them and understanding their perspective in terms of the financial options available to the state, including getting some color and understanding some of the assumptions around the state's cost of debt going forward. And we'll talk about that. We also had a chance to obviously talk to the Department of Natural Resources and understand, since they were sort of taking the lead in putting this case forward, understanding their perspective and their rationale. And coming here, you know, we had a chance, as Janik said, to sit through essentially every single hearing on both this and the other body to understand all the nuances of the argument and to listen to the testimony and read through all the reports. And I say all that because I know there's a healthy appetite in Alaska always about dueling consultants. And so we wanted to sort of start off by saying that, you know, when we step back and we look at the, you know, majority of the case put forward by the administration and its consultants, you know, we largely feel comfortable with that case. We think the numbers make sense. We think the assumptions and many of the statements that have been made make a lot of sense. We've listed here a series of statements that you may have heard from Commissioner Myers, Deputy Commissioner Rutherford, from DEPA, from Greengate, from First Southwest. And essentially, these are all statements that we would largely agree with. If this is something that the committee would like to get into and more and understand why we agree and why we don't disagree, or we're happy to do that. But we thought it would be easier to just kind of say that up front so that you understand a little bit where we're coming from. And I'm just going to read these statements just to for people who are not maybe looking at the slides. You know, the first and broader statement is that the state of Alaska will pay TransCanada no matter what happens, whether this project is successful or not, whether you terminate their relationship now or whether you get into a 25, 30-year relationship. You will essentially be paying TransCanada for the services it is providing. That the state of Alaska retains most of the risk because you ultimately pay no matter what, but that is in the structure of the relationship, TransCanada retains much of the decision-making. There are some exceptions in terms of voting on the work plan and the budget, but in most other cases, at least in our read of the precedent agreement, TransCanada has a lot of the decision-making. The credit rating impact on the state, our view is similar to the view that was put forward by Greengate and First Southwest, that whether you have TransCanada or whether you do this on your own, the way that banks and financial institutions and credit rating agencies are going to look at this is going to be mostly similar, right? So there isn't, you know, you're not looking at a major downgrade if you go one path, but no downgrade if you go a different path. That's not the possible outcomes for you. Moreover, that, you know, the state has many financial options available to it, and there is no need, and we use a little bit of a word panic here. I don't think anyone has panicked, so we're not trying to calm anyone who's panicking. But, you know, there's lots of financial options still available to you. This is still a very preliminary phase of the project, and that you have many ways in which you could, you know, if you looked at the $15 billion and were somehow concerned, you still have a lot of options ahead of you to be able to mitigate that. And this is not something that just because you potentially terminate the relationship with TransCanada that somehow someone has to pony up $15 billion anytime soon. So we would agree with that statement as well.
Expand on what those options are a little bit while you're right on that point.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. Nikos Tsafos, for the record. There's a number of things that the state of Alaska could do, and we'll get a little bit more into that when Janik talks about the cost of debt to the state. Broadly speaking, I would put them in sort of three or four big buckets. One is you're going to take back, if you pass this piece of legislation and execute the deal with TransCanada, you're going to have this 25% share back to you. And one way in which partners around the world finance their projects is they sell some of that share, possibly down the road. So if you look at some point three, four years from now and say, I don't think I have $15 billion, I would like to sell some of that. At that point, you could sell some of that share, actually raise some immediate money. Companies pay hundreds of millions and sometimes billions of dollars to get into the project once it's underway in the development phase. So selling down some equity is one option. Getting financing from the official sector. These are sort of state financial institutions, export-import banks. These have a very long established role to play in developing LNG projects, and they are usually able to provide substantial sums of money at market or usually below market rates. So that's another option that's available to the state. Project finance, the idea that you would essentially raise debt at the level of the project and that that debt would be guaranteed by the revenues of the project. That's another option that would be available to you, and that usually means that the interest that you pay is determined by the risk of the project rather than the sovereign. Right. So there are places, for instance, in Papua New Guinea, where maybe some lender would be more comfortable lending to Papua New Guinea LNG than they would be lending to Papua New Guinea. And so you create a structure whereby you try to insulate the project from some of the sovereign level risk, and therefore able to get more attractive financing that you would be available at the state level. And then, of course, you have all the options that are available to a sovereign in general, whether that is general obligation bonds or other bonds. You have, of course, equity options. You do have an enormous asset base that could be deployed in a number of ways in support of this project, depending on what the desires of the state are. So, you know, when you step back and think about this, you know, it's easy to say we're going from $7 billion to $15 billion. But really, this is a very early development phase, and you have a lot of options. The last thing I would say to that is it's pretty unusual at this development phase to have a very detailed financial blueprint. Financing is something that projects usually do in the FEED stage and may sign when they take final investment decision, sometimes even a little bit after you take final investment decision, provided you're sure you have the financing, you just haven't signed on the dotted line. So the absence of a detailed financial blueprint is not something that would concern us at this time, because it is generally premature at this phase of development to be able to come up and say, we're going to issue this much in debt, we're going to put this much equity, it's coming from there, these are the banks. It's pretty unusual to have that kind of detail at this development phase. So the absence of that is not something that would concern us at this stage. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The next thing is, as Janek said, you know, this is really the only clean off-ramp that the state has. In our understanding of the Memorandum of Understanding terms, that if the state were to enter into a firm transportation service agreement, that firm's transportation service agreement would enable TransCanada to come into a project substantially similar to this one in the event of a termination. So this is essentially the only time you can sever the relationship and really be able to say goodbye. Any severing of the relationship after you've signed a firm transportation service agreement would not be quite as clean and separable. Okay. The next statement, of course, is not having AGEA makes a big difference, at least in the way that we think about it, in the way that the administration has thought of it, that the decision making last year was in some way over the cloud of AGEA, and in some ways the leverage that the two parties had was different because of AGEA. And then lastly, getting an understanding and having the ability to test the relationship vis-a-vis non-alignment and transparency of information. These are both things that the administration has talked about. You know, we would largely agree that if either of those things are true, and we don't know firsthand because we're not in the votes, we don't participate in the negotiations, but based on what they said, you know, if these statements are true, we would agree that those seriously undermine the original case for including TransCanada in the Alaska LNG project. So these are all statements that we think the administration has put forward to bolster its case, and these are statements that we would, in large part, subscribe to. Having said that, you know, what are we doing here? What we would like to do is a couple of things. First, given where the state is and given the options available to the state, and in particular, at least for us, listening to Mr. Vincent Lee yesterday when you asked him what would happen if you didn't pass this, and he said, well, we would probably go to the December 4th meeting and vote no. You know, given all that, it's not clear that the state has particularly, you know, a large set of compelling options and alternatives in front of it. And as a result of that, what we wanted to make our presentation focus on is really two things. One, contextualize and offer some commentary on some of the financials, on the financial case that has been put forward by the administration. Again, we largely agree with the numbers. We've just had a chance to talk a little bit more with them about the assumptions, and we think that you understanding some of those assumptions will be useful in you understanding exactly what's driving some of these numbers. So that's the first thing we want to talk about. So it's not really challenging the numbers, but just telling you a little bit of the commentary that we would like to add around these numbers in order for the legislature and this body to be more comfortable with understanding the full picture. And secondly, you know, as Janik said, and as the report I think made clear, we primarily see this as a strategic question, not necessarily a financial question. And we'll get into the details of why we don't think that financially this makes a huge amount of difference, or at least it's not obvious today that it makes a huge amount of difference. And so we wanted to talk about the strategic operational management aspects of that, and really not talk about whether you should or shouldn't do it, but if you are going to go down this path of terminating the relationship with TransCanada, there are some implications of that in terms of what you should be thinking about, in terms of, you know, we had made some assumptions about this, the TransCanada team advancing the state's interest in certain ways. Well, if they're not around, we have to have a new plan for how to advance those interests. So that's really what we want to focus our presentation on. And if there are no questions with that, I'm going to hand it back to Janik to take us through some of the financials.
It probably will be, but we'll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Again, for the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. In putting the financials in context, we wanted to focus in particular on sort of two key statements that have been made and made frequently that we don't by any means dispute, but as Nikos said, that we want to put in context. The first is that the state could potentially achieve up to $400 million in incremental annual cash flows based on lower cost of capital. And the second is the question of, you know, what the state's credit outlook might look like, for instance, were it to raise the entire $15 billion of capital commitment required for this project in the form of debt, and how that cost of debt might compare to the TransCanada option. So those are the two things we want to focus on. One thing to say before getting into that is that one thing that might in some ways be added to sort of the list of points of areas we agree with the administration wholeheartedly on is, you know, one needs to look at this question of cost of financing in both a success case and a failure case. And in the case of the failure case, that is the case that the project doesn't move forward, we think it's fairly unambiguous that the cost of financing to the state is a lot less than it is by itself than with TransCanada. In the case of TransCanada's involvement, where TransCanada is effectively financing the state's share, as we've heard many times, up until construction, and indeed really up until the first year after in-service, the state's interest rate is 7.1%. And in fact, particularly up until FID, it's fixed at 7.1%. It doesn't float with the equity tracker. That gets fixed at FID. Up until that point, it's clear from the MOU terms that the interest rate is exactly 7.1% on all of the costs that TransCanada is currently incurring. And clearly these are all expenses that the state can currently meet from its available both, you know, assets and if need be bonding capacity. And you know, for instance, where the state to do that through bonding at the moment, clearly it's a AAA rated sovereign that can raise debt very cheaply. And that in that sense, in the failure leg, I think there's no question that the state financing this by itself is absolutely a cheaper option than the state relying on financing from TransCanada. In the success case, the case that the project reaches a final investment decision, is constructed, goes into operation, we would certainly agree with the administration that it's very hard for us to see a case in which the state could be better off strictly financially through the TransCanada deal. We think that at best it's a wash, and that there are then gradations of how much better off financially one could be. Again, forgetting for a moment the strategic case that Nikos will talk about and looking solely at the finances. And we really just want to put some of these numbers in perspective and say that being the case, it's also important not to oversell the strictly financial case, and that, you know, some of the statements that are made about, you know, up to $400 million in additional annual cash flows need to be contextualized in order not to, to look at this and think, oh, well, obviously on purely financial grounds we should do this, and that's reason enough by itself. So there are two sort of slides here shown in a couple of administration presentations making this case. I think we will come back to these, come back to this slide. We're still on slide four at the moment for those online. I think we'll step through five and six to start getting into some of the detail of the assumptions behind these and maybe come back and forth a bit as we explore these. So on the question of the up to $400 million, or it turns out, if one digs into the details, a little more, up to $360 million in additional annual cash flows in a no TransCanada versus a TransCanada case under the administration's modelling, the main thing we wanted to point out is that isn't necessarily comparing apples with apples, that there is an additional $2 billion in upfront investment under this modelling, and you can in fact see this point of work?
Yep.
You can see this up here right on the additional negative of the blue line. That's the basic idea underlying this model is that the investment that was otherwise taken by TransCanada would be financed 70-30 by the state, 30% equity, 70% debt, and so 30% of $7 billion or $2 billion that the state puts up in addition, and then for that, if one assumes basically the same cost of debt in both worlds, it's 5% cost of debt in both worlds, that you get, depending on assumptions, around $360 million in annual cash flow. Now, if you look at that, and again, I think the Black and Veatch report shows this, and weigh it on a net present value basis, that's worth between a little over zero to greater amounts, depending on the discount rate you use. We would argue very strongly that it's, in looking at any commercial investment, it's very important to use a commercial discount rate in weighing the time value of money, and that's a discussion we can get into in more detail if people are finance geeks and really want to talk about discount rates. But I think there are other ways of approaching the question of the time value of money other than talking about that. So if no one's super keen to get into that, I think there are other ways we can broach that. There are other things. So that's the world of the sort of $360 million a year in additional cash flows on this chart. And we want to talk a bit about sort of the world of some of these lower annual cash flows and how these are arrived at, and talk a bit more about what we think are the most relevant numbers to look at.
Could you just say something just so the record is clear on this?
Wait till we're done.
It's relevant to this very one point.
We'll come back to it, please, if we can.
Okay, it's just what he's saying is exactly what was presented by Black and Veatch. They also said subtract $2 billion from that amount.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I agree. We're not trying to contradict Black and Veatch. We're trying to reemphasize that point and make sure that the people are aware of that. We don't disagree with them or suggest that anything has been, you know, presented that isn't completely upfront. We're just trying to make sure that we reemphasize the point. Just go to the next slide. So come back to some of the assumptions on those previous two slides. But first, I thought it would be useful to think about this question of, you know, one of the easiest comparisons to make is the question of were we to completely replace the effective financing. We've said the effective financing of TransCanada is akin to a loan, is akin to debt. And so were the state to effectively replace that entirely with debt, what would that cost the state, and what sort of rates could the state achieve if it were to try to achieve the same thing entirely through general obligation bonding? Now, in looking at this, we haven't done any of our own, you know, analysis. We aren't detailed sovereign debt financial advisors. We've looked at the numbers that First Southwest have provided, and these are the same numbers that underpin some of the charts that you see. And we've talked through some of this in detail. We've also sort of, you know, created our own version of their model and played a bit with some of the assumptions to make sure that we're happy with how they go about these numbers. But basically the idea is to say that at any given credit rating, we can roughly draw a line that says, if you think about this in context of debt service as a proportion of general unrestricted funds, how much, you know, what level of that ratio can you get up to at a particular credit rating? And the idea that underlies their assumptions is that, you know, if you're underneath 5% debt service ratio, you can retain the AAA credit rating. And that, you know, once you get up to 8%, between 5 and 8%, you're in a AA plus world, up to 10% a AA world, and you steadily go down until, you know, at the 20% of debt service as a proportion of general fund, unrestricted fund revenue, you're in a A2/A credit rating world. And again, if we look at their model and look at, based on what in some ways we have to say are certainly not pessimistic assumptions, right? The modeling work is based on the financial projection of the revenue sources book from this last spring, which assumes a return to $110 oil by 2020, slightly growing oil prices after that. And then at the 2024 point, essentially a flat continuation of revenues. So the state is back to sort of $4 billion annual revenues by the latter part of this decade, and that continues indefinitely. And so when you assume all of these things and look at, you know, at each of these debt service rates, if this is a slightly artificial exercise, and I think it's important to state that, if you were to imagine that the state issued, you know, had one single tranche of bond issuance, how much could it raise? Now, obviously the state, whatever its financing strategies are, and it has many, the state is not going to do this through a single tranche of bond issuance, and it would, if we're doing this entirely through general obligation bonds, have multiple tranches raised at steadily increasing rates and lower rated over time. But if you'd imagine doing this in one issuance to raise fully $15 billion, we're really talking about going down to a credit rating in the world of A2A. And we think that's important to understand in the context of, you know, for instance, under First Southwest Zone numbers, that's an interest rate there of about 5.34, for instance, is the numbers that we have through their presentation. And so if we come back to one previous and think about these slides, you know, those same interest rates that we saw on that page are the interest rates that underlie the gray bars in the right-hand side chart here, right? And so, yes, it's good to see that, you know, at a AAA credit rating, the state has a much lower cost of debt than TransCanada, but that once we get to raising the levels of debt we're talking about for a project like this, again, bearing in mind the slightly artificial assumption of a single issuance, all general obligation bond debt at one point in time, but it's important to realize that you're up to a world of, in either case, comparing like and like moment in time to moment in time, in the success case with TransCanada, based on where 30-year treasuries are at this point, 5.8% versus 5.5%, let's say 5.34, 5.5 in the general obligation bond world. So yes, that's still less, but and we would certainly say that we can't see a case in which it's worse than the TransCanada option for the sole reason that the financing the state receives through TransCanada is effectively obtained by providing the state's full faith and credit to the market. And in the sense that if that didn't raise capital at the rate required, TransCanada always has the ability to leave anyway. So we certainly don't see a case in which one is, again, viewing this purely in financial terms, better off in the TransCanada case. We just wanted to point out that there are many scenarios you can see where the spread in these numbers is much narrower than could easily appear at first sight looking at some of the charts. So if we then come back to this question of, you know, comparing like with like, what might the additional annual revenues in the non-TransCanada case look like? This chart here that was shown by Black and Beach is quite useful because other than the 360, the idea is basically that all of the other numbers that appear on this chart are done comparing like with like, essentially assuming not 70-30 debt equity, but 100% debt. And so with no additional investment of equity capital, how does that benefit appear? And what this looks like then, assuming a number of different debt interest rates for the state in raising that capital. And so, for instance, if we're in the world of, say, 5.5%, which I think seems not unreasonable from what we've just been looking at, we're talking about $130 million a year in additional annual revenues rather than $400. And more than anything else, we wanted to think about things in that context and not get too carried away with the big upfront numbers of $400 million in annual revenue a year more. It's still a substantial amount of money. It's still important to consider, but we wanted to make sure people understand that. And we particularly wanted to make sure people understand that in the context of thinking, you know, this also assumes that the TransCanada financing option looks at 7.1% during construction, 6.75% in service. As we saw on the previous slides, the comparison we were making, for instance, on that the slide with the red and the grey bars is between 5.8 at the moment versus 5.34. So the spread is actually narrower at the moment, and if we're in a world of higher treasury rates, that spread remains the same. It's just everything moves up or down. So in that sense, I think when we look at this and think long and hard about what we see the potential benefit being in a world in which this is all done through geo-bonding, we kind of see, I think, you know, 130, 100 is the upper limit of the benefit, and cases when we can imagine it being less. That's particularly, and then in particular, it's important to remember, and I think there hasn't been a lot of discussion over the last week or so of the fact that there was an equity option agreement as part of the deal with TransCanada, and that if one was looking at this strictly in financial terms, wanted their participation, thought that the strategic case there was compelling, but wanted to reduce this exposure, there was also an ability to say, well, actually, we want back 40% of this, and we could effectively cut this additional expense in close to half.
Do you have anything you want to
back to me?
Or do you want to start? Yeah, so I think that mostly covers, as I say, we don't disagree with any of the numbers that have been presented. We just think it's important to put them in context in thinking this through, because in our view, the financial case is important, but this is also a strategic decision, and strategic costs and benefits need to be weighed against what the financial case is. With that, I'll hand it over to Nikos to talk more about the strategic issues.
Thank you, Janik. For the record, Nikos Tsafos. First of all, I think I want to comment that this is a historical moment. I think this is the first time we've put up a cartoon in an Analytica slide. So I think if you'd like that and like to see more, just give us that feedback, and we can take out some of the charts in future presentations. So it's all going to depend on how you react to this slide. So I just want to make sure you understand the stakes here. What we wanted to talk about in this slide is really just kind of step back and again, understanding that the decision in front of you is much narrower than this. You don't have to answer all these questions. But we think of it as having spent some time here in June over the last week, listened to all the presentations. It's sort of the type of questions that are popping up in our minds, and we want to just kind of throw some of these things out there as food for thought as we go forward into this process. As we've said many times, we're still at a very early stage of development. It may not seem like it, but we really are a very early stage of development. And so the more we're thinking and asking good questions up front, I think the better the outcome is going to be for everyone. And really for us, you know, this inflection point with TransCanada is really allowing us to kind of go back and revisit and talk about some of these questions. I wanted to focus on these four areas. And again, this is mostly based on sort of testimony and conversations. We haven't actually had a chance to confer with AGDC yet. Would like to do that, so understand a little bit better where they're coming from. So this isn't a really full sort of review of anything. This is just more of a brainstorming and sort of food for thought for some of these questions. You know, the one thing that, you know, we did see, and this was in front of your committee, was, you know, the project staffing. And really, it wasn't so much the project staffing, right, the 135 people project management team, but more generally the question of, you know, how are all these pieces coming together, right? You saw a sponsors group, MANCOM, steering committee, project management team, and different organizations being in charge of different things. And really the question that we're trying to understand is, you know, how do all these pieces come together, right? This is a team effort. You know, how do you ensure that at the highest level, the sponsor group, sets the broad direction for the interests of the state, and that, you know, throughout the chain down to the people that are doing the very nitty-gritty technical work, you know, they're helping make decisions at the ground level that really reinforce that strategic vision. And so I think, you know, this is an evolving process, but it is a question that I think, you know, the more everyone can get comfortable with where the state is headed, I think the better it will be for the state in terms of the outcome. And there was one particular question, what I think is really framed by TransCanada, is that at least going back to the discussions we had all here in SB 138, you know, one of the big things and one of the big attractions of TransCanada at the table, and as Janek said, was that the state thought that TransCanada was essentially going to have its back when it came to expansions, that, you know, the state and the producers are essentially, you know, they are not aligned on the question of expansions, right, that the producers have a resource base that they would like to optimally develop. The state would like to open up the basin, right? And so in having that, these discussions, it was going to be helpful to have someone at the table who understands expansions and understands the commercial terms of putting a pipeline together. And if you remember, you know, we had a lot of discussions last year in terms of the HOA and the clauses that allowed each party on its own to be able to trigger an expansion as long as it didn't adversely affect the other party. So these were, at least in our understanding from the previous administration, these were clauses and provisions that TransCanada helped the state negotiate and make sure we're putting in those negotiations. And so as we think about the future, the question is, you know, how are we going to backfill these positions, how are we going to backfill that expertise? And it's not, you know, we haven't been in the room for the last 18 months, so we don't know to what extent that was the case, you know, from the beginning of 14 to the present. So we're not saying that, you know, TransCanada was doing all these things, who's going to do it now? But that was the argument, that was the idea. So, and we see expansions both at the current moment, and I realize it's a little bit premature about talking about how to expand the pipe that we haven't built yet, so we fully realize that. But how you set up the foundation makes a difference, right? If you think you're building a pipe for one purpose, you built it in a certain way, and if you think you're building a pipe for a different purpose, you built it in a different way. And you agree the commercial and governance agreements to regulate and govern this pipeline in a different way, depending on where you want to end up. And so the question is, you know, how will the state then be able to do the things that TransCanada was supposed to do? And again, we can't say whether they did or did not do that. And then there's a next stage, again, of, you know, once the project is in operation, let's sort of close our eyes and think it's 2026 now, and, you know, the gas is flowing and we're all very happy. You know, at that time, the idea was, again, that the idea, we don't know, the idea was that TransCanada would be the one sort of going around and talking to all the explorers and trying to figure out who had gas and how much gas they had and, you know, how far away they were from the pipe and what it would cost to bring that gas to connect, to be connected, and what kind of tariff they would charge them, and they would be the ones to do the technical and the commercial work. That was the idea. That was the case. The case was that, well, they'd like to have more molecules. Let them kind of go chase around and find these people and try to figure out if it's going to make sense. And, you know, if we don't have TransCanada, then someone else has to do that from the perspective of the state that likes to have as much gas through. And again, that doesn't mean that you have to go hire anyone right now for that purpose, right? So we're not talking about today's world, but it's an implication of going with this type of decision, that you have to start thinking about those questions, both from a today's governance and project structure perspective and aligning sort of the different parts of the state behind these goals, but also starting to think that, okay, if we don't do that, then maybe we have to budget the fact that in 2026 we may need more people than we thought as a result of having to go and do this if it's going to be the state doing it. The last two points we wanted to bring up, and then I'm going to hand it over to Janek to close us up here, is, you know, and again, this is mostly a reaction to the conversation that has happened this week in Juneau, is, you know, we think that this is also a good opportunity to start talking a little bit more about the financing structure of the state. And this was triggered a little bit by, you know, some of the slides and the conversations around, you know, well, we could do 100% debt. right? And, you know, the thing about debt and leverage is that it exposes you to more volatility. You know, if you put zero down on a house, then, you know, most of your rent goes to the bank, right? And if your rent drops a little bit, then you're putting out of pocket to pay the mortgage, right? And so we think that, again, this is in no way does it change necessarily your decision on TransCanada, right? But this is part of the conversation that we think will be very helpful to start having about what is the optimal capitalization structure for the state. You know, do you want to go very heavy down on debt, or do you want to be thinking about equity options? And if you do want to be thinking about equity options, you know, it might be hard in 7 years to write a $10 billion equity check. But if you know you have to do that in 5 years, maybe you do things today to, you know, to prepare yourself for that. So those are the kind of questions that could be helpful to talk about. And then lastly is, and that this was mostly to tie us back to Alice here on the right, is, you know, how you want to answer this question on TransCanada. And again, this may be a little bit more academic, but the question is, you know, where you want to, how you make these decisions ultimately depends on where you want to end up. And we say that in the context of, you know, it seems that we're heading down the path of terminating the relationship with TransCanada. But at the same time, there is discussion about project agreements, for example, withdrawal agreements, where, you know, if one or two parties decide to withdraw from the project, you know, it would sure be nice to have TransCanada around, because they're the kind of company that would like to invest in infrastructure and would like to, you know, not necessarily take ownership of the gas, but shoulder the cost of building infrastructure to transport the molecules. And so the last thing we would say is that, you know, we always need to be thinking about aligning the nitty-gritty individual decisions with the broad strategic question. And this seems to us like an inflection point where, okay, we may be going down one path in terms of TransCanada, while at the same time talking about possible project outcomes where it would be nice to have TransCanada. So those kind of questions about how we align today's decision making with where we want to end up, you know, the more we can have of those, I think the better served the state would be. I'm going to turn it over to Janik to add a few things, and then we're going to stop and take questions.
Thank you. For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. I think the only additional thing I have to add to that is in thinking about the options that the state has at this point, I think I'm ultimately reminded of testimony a couple of days ago, and in particular Representative Kawasaki's analogy of the situation with TransCanada, and the, you know, is this a messy divorce? Is this an amicable dissolution? And clearly, you know, I think from the testimony we've seen, this is an amicable dissolution on all sides. We'd like to keep it that way, and we live in a time and an age when two people want an amicable dissolution, we don't by and large try to force them to stay together. And I think that's kind of where we are, and that's kind of the range of options that we have in lots of ways. And so maybe some of this conversation is academic, but, you know, in particular in framing these questions on this page, we really, really want people to start thinking about what is the degree of capability that the state requires from this point forward to truly defend its interests in the project. We've heard a lot about, you know, that we know from the project leadership, from ExxonMobil and the rest, that, you know, the project schedule isn't going to slip, particularly because TransCanada is no longer a part. And that's nice to hear. It would also be nice if, you know, we the state had, you know, at a detailed level on the ground, on the project, working these things, enough folks that we could independently reach that conclusion for ourselves. In particular, you know, while, you know, when we look at the project, we don't have any great concern about the ability of the project to proceed in terms of optimization and development of the existing resource base. We see that the state clearly has three very strong, very capable partners that can progress this thing forward in any case. We do want to make sure that the state has the capability to, where it's relevant, express differences of strategic interest. That, and that some of that we've heard in recent weeks about the question of 42 versus 48-inch line and the merits in either direction, and wanting more details on that. And that, but that plays itself out, you know, on a detail level in every possible discussion that happens around this project, right? On the most minute questions of sizing of different components of the liquefaction trains, of the GTP, you know, how, in making particular decisions, how much future capacity do we have for debottlenecking of trains, to give one particular example. And it's not always a foregone conclusion that the state's interests will align perfectly with the producer's interests on some of these questions. And so for that reason, it's going to be crucial that we have people at every level of the organization deeply integrated and working on these things and really understanding, having both the detailed technical background as well as the, you know, high-level experience and commercial background to understand how the state's strategic interests play out, both in terms of the broad governance agreements that govern things like expansion terms, and how that trickles down to every single aspect of the project, down to, you know, the sizing of individual components. And thinking about that organization and what that organization looks like, I think more than anything else, is what we would like to urge everyone involved in this process to start thinking about, given where we're now headed.
Thank you. That was I like the way you did the presentation on page 7 here. I think it was just a very open, candid discussion that we had on there, and I think that was informative. Mr. Tofflos, you've stated in the past that if or when a project goes to FEED, front-end engineering and design, that it's a very good sign because most projects that make it to the FEED stage ultimately move forward. I'm curious to hear your opinion of what you think that means, if anything, that some of the work plan and in budget for AKLNG project wants to move money, some of it from formerly FEED into pre-FEED. There's been an expansion of the time and the request for funds on that. Is that typical of a project like this?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the record, Nikos Tsafos. Let me, if I may, step back one level and talk a little bit more existentially, if you will. You know, when I look at the project and with a cost range publicly quoted of $45 to $65 billion, I think where you end up in that range is the most important question that's going to determine the viability of this project. And to put it very frankly, if you're closer to 65, this is really tough. If you're closer to 45, we can get something done. And you really are not going to be able to get a better number until you're finished with the pre-feasibility study. And this is a very, 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 and I can keep adding varies just to make sure the point is, a very serious effort by the project sponsors. I was looking at the revised pre-feasibility budget that was $700 million, I think it might be $694 million, and I realize that $6 million is a big number, but still, about $700 million. And when I saw that number, I turned to Janik and I said, you know, we've had LNG projects that were built for $1 billion a decade ago, right? This is a serious amount of money. And it really speaks to how important it is for the sponsors, including the state of Alaska, to feel comfortable that this can be an economically viable project. When I look at the specific question of trying to shift some of the FEED work to the pre-FEED stage, I think of it in that context, in thinking that, you know what, you've seen these numbers from the administration, from Steve. You may get to FEED, and that's a $1.5-2 billion decision. You don't gamble on a $1.5 to $2 billion. You don't just say, yeah, I have no idea, let's keep going just to see what's going to happen. You know, this is a very serious decision that you make if you feel comfortable about the technical aspects, the regulatory aspects, and the commercial aspects. In short, I think of this as an effort by the project to bring forward some work streams and reduce the level of uncertainty and risk in order to get to the end of FEED at a much better decision point and feel much more comfortable. So in some ways, I think that shifting of costs reflects the challenges that the project faces, but it also gives us comfort that when you finish pre-FEED, you'll have a much better idea about where you're at. And if you're at that point, you and your partners decide to move on to the next stage, I would take that as a very, very positive step, because it means that you've done a ton of work. Very serious companies have done a ton of work. They've brought some of the later work forward to just kind of test a few more things. And if at that stage they say, you know what, we're willing to go on to the next phase, I think that's a very, very significant milestone for the project.
Speaking down that same point,
too much.
You've seen some of the proposed costs to proceed in this. This is Appropriations Bill 3001. Are they in line with the project that you would see with like this? There's been questions of, is the money too much? Is it not enough money? In your opinion, are the requests made in this appropriations bill in line with a project like this?
Mr. Co-Chair, Nikos Tsafos, for the record, broadly speaking, I would say they are in line, and to put it as simply as possible, you know, people in the oil and gas business can make a lot of money working for industry. And if you want the A-team to come join you, you need to pay for these people to come. If you work down in Houston or Singapore or London, which is where the talent is located, it's not uncommon. I have lots of acquaintances that sort of hop jobs every year, year and a half, and with every one of those hops come serious increases in salary. This is an industry that where really good people get paid serious amounts of money. So I can't comment on every single individual item, but when I see six figure salaries with multiple with not a one up front, not even a two up front, it's not uncommon. This is what you have to pay to get serious expertise on the upstream side, on the LNG marketing side. I mean, an LNG marketer, that's a very specific type of expertise that you want people to have gained that expertise in serious marketing organizations. This is essentially, I would say, par for the course, without speaking of the specific individuals you may hire and whether they're worth that or not. But I don't see these numbers and think, what are they thinking? I see these numbers and I say, this is par for the course, and I really hope that Alaska is willing to pay to have the best people come and represent its interests in these negotiations. You are playing, you're not even playing in the NBA or the NBA playoffs. You're playing the NBA finals, right? I mean, most sovereigns get to negotiate with one of these partners and find it tough. You have to negotiate with three of them, right? So this is going to be a very complex negotiation, and I think that you can expect to have to spend a little bit of money to be able to defend your interests up front.
You've also mentioned the value to the state as it moves into FEED, that generally if a project like this moves to FEED, it'll generally move forward. And that has value to the state because there may be entities that want to partner with the state and buy in, and so that adds extra value to the state. So when you analyze, go back to page 4, and you look at some of the scenarios on state debt and ability, credit ratings, the value to the state, because we've got a gas pipeline that looks like it's going to, that has a very high prospect of moving forward, that will add substantial amounts of money back into the state's budget at a time when we're looking to expand our revenue base, to expand the value of the state. Were those figures put into this? That has value. The state will have further additional income. Were those numbers put into this equation or looked at?
Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, these figures, as best I can tell, do not incorporate a dilution of the state's interest. The question is, as you develop the project, you generate value, right? So if someone would like to come into the project in 2017 or 2018 or 2019 in a successful project, they would have to pay up, but they would have to pay up hundreds of millions or possibly billions of dollars, depending on what share they took and so on and so forth. But usually when people come in at that level of development, what they're paying you is the expenses that you've incurred and then a discounted future cash flow of what you can expect to earn from the project. So I would think of that as you're essentially, I don't want to put it in very crude, you're sort of cashing out a little bit of the value. you're saying, well, I could stick around with 25% and make that money over 20 years, but, you know, I would like to reduce my risk a little bit. I would like to bring someone in and maybe make a few $1 billion at the time where I need it, lower my exposure. So you're sort of monetizing that. It's not something that you necessarily capture, because unless you realize it, unless you actually sell down, it's sort of unrealized value just by virtue of your participation in the project. So it enlarges the options that the state has to finance its share of the project, but it's not something that you can, as part of the baseline, capture the financials. But it is something that you can do to look at, you know, if the state in 3 years decided to go from 25% to 20, you know, what that would do, and you could value that. And that's a reasonable exercise to do, and you would have a big cash inflow at that point, and you would have then, you know, less expenditure and less revenue going forward, because instead of 25, you would then have 20%. So it's an exercise that you can do.
But when Wall Street's looking at the credit rating of the state, having this in your pocket for, say, moving forward is a huge advantage to have.
I would say, Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Nikostafos, I think Wall Street and all financial institutions would look at the forecasted revenue and how far along you are in the project in thinking about your credit rating and your credit health. If they thought that this was going to be a successful project in a good cost environment with good revenues, I mean, they would, of course, be taking that into consideration.
The only concern is members of the legislature have concerns about future projects in the state of Alaska and the state's ability to bond them and the credit rating.
Yeah.
So that's, knowing that that's there is a value, I understand. So to the producers, one more question. The producers have value in partnering with the state. You know, the way I see it, we've got a pipeline going through the state of Alaska. State of Alaska also happens to be the entity that does the permitting and works along those lines, the regulations and through that, as opposed to not having the state as a partner. Is there value to the partners in the state? Is there value to the producers in having the state as a partner?
Mr. Chair, I think we'd say that there is definitely a lot of value to everyone involved by having the state involved in the way that it is. I think that's particularly the case when you look back at the entire history of the North Slope and TAPS and, you know, the long history of dispute and litigation over that particular asset, that a big part of the reason for the structure you see at the moment is one in which, rather than simply build things according to one set of interests and then argue about what was fair value and how can we reshuffle that instead that everyone is aligned and involved from the outset and everyone generates value through the project in the same way. And we think that's particularly important because ultimately no one can do anything in any sovereign jurisdiction without the full support of the sovereign, and this is an arrangement in which not only does the sovereign have full support, but the sovereign is actively involved and generating value from the project in the same way that the companies are.
I mention that because I believe it was House Bill 4 that prior piece of legislation that passed that instructed agencies within the state of Alaska, DNR, DEC, if they receive permits from that project, to expedite those permits to the top of the list. And I thought that would be a value and probably considered on this project. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I want to thank you both for the amount of work you've done on this and your perspective and following this project for several years, actually, in reality. I'm excited that we've got three of the biggest oil companies in the world that are wanting to make money. And it's kind of nice to be a 25% partner. If they're going to make money, that means we're going to make money. I really think that this is a positive thing. By the time we get to final investment decision, we'll know exactly if this is going to make some money and where we'll be. I'm not concerned about the financing because if we get to that point, I think that's going to come along pretty easily. My concerns, and I think you've sat through a lot of meetings in the other body and different committee hearings, is the alignment with those and the state of Alaska with those three entities. And the alignment within the state of Alaska. You know, we've got problems with who's going to be in charge to take over TransCanada. Is it going to be Department of Natural Resources or AGDC? I don't know which one of those has the most expertise, but it's a real concern. And we've got a real, you've heard through the meetings, there's a real problem possibly with the state's decision-making. So how do you see the state moving forward with this? Do we jeopardize the project with this indecision in the administration side of the state? And I'm asking for an opinion here, I know. But,
Representative Thompson, through the chair. I think more than anything else, we would come back to sort of reiterating the point that we made on this final slide, right, which is to truly pursue the state's interests as best the state possibly can in this project is going to be actually a pretty monumental effort. And it's going to require it's going to require both an enormous amount of capability and some capabilities that the state has built up in the last few years and some capabilities the state needs to continue to build up. And it's going to require an enormous amount of communication and alignment within the state across different agencies, whether that's between revenue and natural resources, whether that's between those agencies and AGDC, that there needs to be both a very clear, commercially driven strategic picture of what the state's interests are here and where they differ from the producers and how to secure the right high-level agreements, particularly, again, for us, we come back frequently to this question of expansion as when it comes to the actual project implementation, one of the key areas where there could be a divergence of interests. But the ability to take those high-level considerations and commercial interests and embed them not just in the governance agreements, but at every level of the implementation of the project itself, right? That someone is looking to say, okay, there are some key decisions being made on sizing of different components of the liquefaction trains or the GTP trains, and there is a particular cost-benefit analysis here if you are doing this because you're trying to monetize the existing resource base, but maybe there's a different cost-benefit analysis when you're worried about making sure we have debottlenecking expansion capability, and that all these things are aligned so that when in driving down the project cost, the project risk, achieving alignment, all the things that people have reiterated over and over again are important in this project, that at the same time there is a clear commercial strategic interest for the state that is known, that is understood, and that we have the capabilities and the communication at every level that across all of these agencies we understand how we're working together to achieve this, and one hand doesn't not know what the other hand is doing. I think that's incredibly important, and without wanting to cast any aspersions, when one looks at certain things at the moment, I think one is justified in wanting to emphasize the importance of those things, and in particular the importance of coordination across all of these areas working together.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could add one more thing. Nikos Tsafos, for the record, I really appreciated the slide that AGDC showed in terms of the decision-making of the project, right? It started from the far right with the project management team of Steve Butt. He reports to the project steering committee, and they report to the management committee, and the management committee responds to the sponsors committee. In fact, it's so clear that I remember it by heart, even though I only saw it a couple of times. And there were bullet points underneath about who's responsible for what. I think that's I think to play at this level, you need this kind of clarity and say, okay, this is this bubble, this is this bubble, this is this bubble. This bubble is responsible for this, and this bubble is responsible for that. And these people report to these people, and these decisions are made at this level, and these decisions are made at that level. And I think, the closer I think you can get to that level of organizational clarity. I mean, this is, at the end of the day, this is a massive undertaking, right? I mean, I'm just kind of jokingly thinking about the communication challenges I've had in teams of 10, right? I mean, imagine, you have 10 people that are all in the same location and you're trying to figure out what your colleagues are up to and what's going on. I mean, imagine to then take multiple cities, multiple organizations, hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, this is a monumental task organizationally for anyone, right? And I think, this is a work in progress, but the closer you can aspire to that, I think the better off you're going to be.
Just on that point, if I may. We saw an organizational chart of the state of Alaska, but we also saw organizational charts of the project management team. Is the state's assurances that this can stay on track, on budget, on time, fortified by the fact that we've got a professional management team that includes the three major producers? that make the decisions on what has to be done and what gets spent.
Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, I would say we generally take comfort by the number of people and the competence of the people that the project management team consists of. I think that's a, you know, the when you listen, I think, to people like Steve Blatt, you know, you're not sitting there thinking, you know, what's he trying to do, where's he coming from. He's coming from very clear goals and objectives. And I think, you know, when I step back and, I mean, sometimes we forget about it because we're kind of in the weeds. I mean, this is an enormous amount of steel up north, 800 miles of pipe, and then a liquefaction facility down south. I mean, this is an enormous undertaking. And frankly, you know, it's going to be tough for everyone because it's a very difficult project. And generally, I would say that the state should take comfort of the fact that the people trying to crack the code are some of the best people in the industry. Right, and I think even each of the players takes comfort that they have with them the other players because they can feed off each other, they can benefit from each other's expertise, and I think that's a major asset that this project has. You know, Steve Butt likes to say there's no single human being that has all this expertise under their head that they can do, you know, the GDP, the pipe, and the LNG, and who has done this before, because this project hasn't been done before, right? But if you are going to be groundbreaking, I think these are the kind of partners I'd like to break ground with.
Thank you, Representative Thomas.
Thank you. You know, Senate Bill 138 gives AGDC the legislative authority to step in and take over the project work that TransCanada is doing at this time. The project's management team is 135 strong. We saw how that the management team is put together. They have to apply. They want to make sure they have the best people, and they do pick those. AGDC has been a part of this project, 12.5% at this time, if you want to call it. But they do not have anybody on the project management team. Is this showing a lack of expertise with AGDC? Do you think they're going to be able to step up and have some people that have the knowledge to get involved?
Mr. Co-Chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, we heard their explanation in front of this committee and in front of the other body, and we have no reason to doubt that explanation, which was that, you know, at the time of the openings, the organization was focused on other thing, on the ASAP line, and they weren't able to bid for those positions. I would say neither of us have a, you know, inside-out knowledge of the resumes of everyone who works at AGDC. So I don't think we can speak to, you know, how many positions they could fill and who could fill those positions. We've heard a number of names, and we've heard a number of people that seem to have very impressive resumes, but we have no firsthand knowledge of their expertise. The only thing I would say is I think of it almost from the opposite side, which is that, you know, I would take comfort if I saw this chart in 3 months and there were a few more AGDC numbers there. Because it goes back to what Janik was saying, is that you want to make sure that at the micro project day-to-day level, you know, there are people that can look at something and say, I need to call up my boss and say that the project is trying to do that and make sure that, you know, this type of information flow can work and that you don't just have the generals setting the direction. You want to make sure that it falls all the way through. So while we can't speak specifically to the individuals that the company has or the company would like to add, you know, I think that, you know, you should, in general, it would be better for the state to have a bigger number there.
I'd add to that just to say, you know, quite clearly the role that AGDC needs to play from this point forward is very different to the role that it has played in recent years, right? It has a whole new order of magnitude level of challenge that it needs to be able to rise to really be able to effectively advance the state's interests in this project. And again, you know, if it's not capable of that, there'll still be a great project. You've got three really strong producers, and they'll produce a great project. But the question is how, on areas where the state's interest differs, how effectively is the state represented? And I think, you know, one would not expect AGDC to have all of the capabilities to fulfill this new role, given that, you know, in large part the new role hasn't even been given to them yet. But, you know, we are very keen, certainly, to sit down with some of them and understand a little more of their thinking. And I think we would certainly say, you know, to the extent that at some point we saw a clear assessment of what their current capabilities are, what the capabilities required for this new role are, and a plan for how those capabilities are going to be acquired, that would give us a lot of reassurance.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Representative Thompson, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Chairman. First off, I guess I'm going to state the obvious a little bit to clarify for the public that the decision we face is not to authorize construction of an LNG line. That's the final investment decision. We're still in the process of developing the information necessary to make a decision to proceed to the next stage. And I've told people that if you want to win the lottery, you got to buy a ticket. It's just that this is an expensive lottery, and there's still no surety. I certainly hope we win. My question is this. The governor has expressed a willingness, if not demonstrated a desire, to disaggregate our current partnership with the producers and obviously with TransCanada and possibly substitute new equity partners, which he says is not quite yet ripe to discuss with us, should he not get the commitments to commit gas under the withdrawal agreements he's negotiating. Help me and help us understand how TransCanada's involvement going forward might continue to be valuable, maybe in a different way, in a scenario in which the state and the three producers were no longer the only equity partners, or were not even the partners. And then I guess the inverse, for a really long question, what are the risks to project success without TransCanada?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I really hope our odds are better than the lottery. There were a lot of questions there, so let me actually start from the last one, which is what are the risks of success. And I think clearly TransCanada brought a lot of assets to the table, a lot of people to the table, a lot of expertise to the table. And broadly speaking, the argument that the producers in the state can backfill that expertise, I have no independent way to verify that, but I generally believe that it's quite possible. Are you going to end up with the exact same cost, or maybe if you have kept TransCanada in, they would have made some contributions down the line that could have, you know, led to a lower cost or a less risky project? I think that's possible. It's unknowable at this time, but you know, your assumption is that if you have really smart people working with you, you may get to a better outcome. We don't really know exactly what you're giving up by not having them continually engaged in the project. That's just, we just can't know that. When I think about the broader question you asked, and again, there's maybe about two or three different directions to take this, so let me try to disaggregate that as well. There's one part which is withdrawal agreements and the possibility that the state essentially gets to a point of being able to agree with the producers that if the producers don't want to participate in this project, or if one of the producers, two or three of the producers, don't want to go ahead, our understanding from the governor's statements is that he would like for the state to have two different options to deal with such a eventuality. One, for the producers to sell their gas at the wellhead to presumably the state, but not sure, or for the producers to not invest in the infrastructure but toll their gas through the infrastructure that someone else constructs, right? And again, this is all based on the public statements of the governor. Now, in the event that you get to an outcome where one of the producers doesn't want to participate and you want to build infrastructure that the producers toll through, you know, in that scenario, you would probably be looking for companies like TransCanada that like to build infrastructure and charge tariffs to get paid back for that infrastructure. So if you were turned up in a project structure where the producers were no longer interested in owning or participating in the infrastructure, you would be out there looking for other parties to do that. And big pipeline companies would be one of the obvious candidates that you would go knocking on their on their doors. Okay, so in that regard, you know, if the project were to take a turn like that, you know, it would make sense to either bring back TransCanada. It's probably maybe too late to keep them in, but you know, it's a project structure where it would make sense to have a third party infrastructure owner to facilitate the project development. If you think about more broadly the questions of buyers coming into the project, the buyers tend to like to focus on the upstream or the liquefaction. I can't speak about the market's appetite for taking a big chunk of a GTP and a pipe, but it's fairly unusual to get big chunks of that. It varies, but it's hard to say at this stage what that would look like and what having or not having TransCanada, what the implications would be. The final thing I would say is, you know, when you think about those agreements, you know, there is a possible risk to the state, right, which is that, you know, at the end of the day, the only circumstance under which Exxon, BP, and Conoco would sell you gas at the wellhead is if they determined that participating fully in the project was not economic for them, right, that they could make more money selling you gas at the wellhead rather than participating in the project. That's the only circumstance under which this option would have any meaning. And at that point, to put it very mildly, this is, you only end up with that gas if that gas doesn't have quite as much value or it's harder to monetize this gas. So there are some risks to the state depending on how you develop these agreements and what kind of rights and obligations the different parties have. But, you know, if you were to end up with all this gas and possibly a slightly bigger part of the pie, you know, you would be likely looking to shed some of that risk, especially because the only circumstance under which this would happen would be in a higher risk project where it's slightly more difficult for the economics to work out. So the only time you'll be in that position is if it's in a tough position rather than a good position. They won't sell you the gas if they think there's tons of money to be made, and they won't let you just go make the money yourself. You know, they will only do that if they can't think the project can work.
Representative Taylor?
Yeah, I guess I'll just follow up briefly. Have you seen, you guys have more experience in the LNG business. Have you seen any hints or indications of whether that might be the way this is being tracked, is to disaggregate the current partnership agreement? You guys will know the signs that we won't.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'll answer this in two ways. And this actually goes back to a question that Representative Guerra asked us back in Anchorage during our LNG course. It's not uncommon if a project gets stuck to try to come up with a different structure, right? So if for some reason you come to the realization that one or more of the parties isn't interested in the current structure, you try to figure out another structure that would work for them, right? So if someone says, I don't want to invest, you know, $15 billion in this project because of a number of reasons, you know, you can either wait or you can help them reduce their share, or you can say, well, what if you only stay in the upstream and then we take on the risk? So it's not uncommon to try to tweak the project structure to get to every party to have the risk-reward relationship that it desires. So as a broad statement, this is not about Alaska, as a broad statement, this is one way in which you deal with parties being on different pages in terms of what they want to participate. Now, specifically regarding the LNG, the AK LNG project, I would say I can't say that I have, and I'll speak for myself. I know Janik may have a slightly different color on this. I don't think that there's a definitive, I couldn't say definitively about whether or not you're moving towards a different path. I think that, you know, there's different way, you have, you know, a set of interests, and there are different ways to meet those interests. I can't say that, you know, when you're spending all this money on the AKLNG project, you're part of the groups and you're making the cash calls. You know, that doesn't tell me, that it's hard for me to look at that and say, you're not participating in this project as it's currently envisioned, right? I mean, you are. You're involved in this project. Now, are there occasions where there are statements where you say, okay, that looks like a slightly different project? That also happens. But I can't say that, you know, looking at this project right now, that I would conclude that this is that there's a very different project structure definitively being pursued. I think there's just thinking and wavering, frankly.
And through the chair, Janica Mayer, Analytica, I would add to that only to say, you know, I agree with all of Nikos's assessment on that front. We mentioned at the outset in sort of presenting our views on some of this that we have worked very closely with branches of the administration in trying to understand in more detail all the work that they were doing, trying to understand their numbers. We particularly appreciate some of the access we've been given to the sort of state gas team that's been assembled in DNR. And I think when we talk to a whole range of people, we get the impression of a lot of very smart, very capable people making very good progress in, you know, despite difficult negotiations on contentious issues, down the track of the heads of agreement that was, you know, that framed everything in SB 138. Every now and then, on a higher political level, one hears occasional comments that cause one to scratch one's head and think, I'm not sure how this squares. I don't know, we can say any more than that. We see these two things, we don't know how they come together, we'll see how this all plays out, but we certainly have a huge amount of respect for the technical capability and the commitment of the teams that are working to advance what we see on that level as working very, very hard to advance things and believing in the ability to advance things under the structure that the legislature has set out.
And final comment, and part of the progress of these hearings and the questions and the dialogue we're having publicly is to see where, if there are hang-ups in the process that militate towards changing the structure, where that responsibility lies. I have not seen evidence that it's TransCanada holding things up, and we have not had the producers here in front of us yet, but I've not seen evidence that they don't want to get the gas to which they own lease rights and have paid. They want to get that to market, so it leaves me to figure out, I'm not quite sure where the hang-ups are or why and what that might imply. Thank you.
Sir. Thank you. I don't know if there is a wife in these guys.
No comment.
Okay, Representative Satter, Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chairman. I have a second question. I think that's going to be my more primary question, but just listening to the discussion, it seems more apparent to me, what's it, day five, day six, or whatever we're at in the process, that you truly can have organizational clarity, but at the same time you could have confusion in terms of the leadership hierarchy. And as a policymaker, you know, I'm here to certainly do everything I can to make sure Alaska gets the best reward or gets the best value for this long-term business relationship that we need to enter into in order to make this project happen. But at the same time, I worry that if we have a legislature and an executive branch that are at odds with each other, how to go forward in any matter, you know, in a period of low commodity prices, thin margins, that, you know, it could have a detrimental impact to a project that's really just starting to get off the ground. And I don't think all that warrants another question because you've fielded several thus far, and I think you've sort of very artfully stated your response to all of that. But I wanted to just sort of put that on the record as a concern that, you know, for me seems to build more and more every day. And my hope is that when the special session concludes in some manner, that from a policy standpoint, that we will be able to positively influence that in a way that, you know, that we can all be together when Alaska sits down at the table and exercises its 25% voting rights in terms of the actual decision-making, because I think that's a critical component to this overall project going forward. In lieu of all the economic analysis, all the financial numbers that, you know, we're going to be party to, question I wanted to ask.
was no electronics at the desk?
There absolutely is not. Evan, when I get back home, we'll talk about that later with my son. But the question I wanted to ask was about the size of the pipe. Mm-hmm. Taking into consideration AGOCC's recent ruling about gas offtakes and the fact that there really wasn't uniformity amongst the producers in terms of the eventual 3.7 billion cubic feet number that AGOCC ultimately arrived at. But I wanted to give you both an opening maybe to talk a little bit more about that decision in relationship to a commercially viable project, and then tying that into the earlier discussion we've had with a 42 versus maybe a 48-inch size pipeline.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, happy to do so. I actually would like, if you will indulge me, to walk you through a little bit of our own evolution on this topic, because I think we sort of started from some perspective, and then the more we've looked into it, we had a chance to talk a little bit with the administration side on how they're thinking. So I'd like to walk you through a little bit of that evolution as well in our own thinking. So starting in the very big picture, the 42 versus 48, our point of departure is a graph that Steve Butt showed in the joint resources hearings in Palmer, I think, a few months ago. And what he showed is the production profile for Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. And essentially what the graph showed is that you have gas in these two fields to maintain a plateau level for about 16 to 17 years. And that after that point, you start to go into decline. And if you want to keep the original AKLNG, I'm not talking about expansions, the original AKLNG project going for another 10 years, you probably need another source of gas of the size of Point Thompson. Right? That's essentially what you need to keep AKLNG running for essentially 27, 28 years. That's the starting point. And that our understanding, I think, before getting into the details of this, was that the current design of the 42-inch pipe would have about 1 billion cubic feet a day of additional capacity into it, that if you added compression, you would be able to add, you know, 1 billion cubic feet a day of production through the pipe. And 1 billion cubic feet a day is roughly the size of Point Thompson, right? So our starting point was to say, well, at the current design, really, if you have two Point Thompsons, the pipe should be able to meet your needs, because you need probably one Point Thompson to expand, and then you need another Point Thompson just to backfill the decline of the production from Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson after year 16. And I'll get in a little bit to the producers and their views on AOGCC and the offtake, but this is the macro picture. I think the question that we've since sort of appreciated more is, you know, to have that 1 billion cubic feet a day of expansion, you need to add a lot of compression, which is going to be costly and it's going to use a lot of fuel. And you also need to have sort of very good expansion terms in the contract, right? Because essentially you're building this pipe that has a little bit of extra capacity to it. And just to give you a bad scenario, not a bad scenario, but a scenario, let's say that, you know, BP makes a discovery. You know, can the state of Alaska offer that 1 BCF a day on its own to a third party? Or can BP say, well, I've made a discovery, I would like to expand it? So what exactly are the rights to use that extra, you know, 1 BCF a day, right? And what are both from the governance as well as from the economics of, you know, how much do I need to put in, and what are the economic implications of the fuel used? You seem like you want to add something. Sorry.
Very, very quickly, John Kamara, for the record. When we think about governance rights over expansion, I'd add one other thing to Nicholas's example, which is, you know, how are the costs of expansion borne, right? If there's a substantial cost to substantial addition compression, both in terms of the capital cost of that, but in particular in terms of the operating cost of the fuel, the governance terms are going to determine how those costs are borne as to whether they're entirely borne by an expanding party, whether others are going to contribute. And some of that trade-off is going to be hugely determinative for the state in terms of, you know, what the state ultimately thinks the risk-reward of 42 versus 48-inch looks like.
For the record, Nikos Tsafos, and so that was sort of where we were on 42, and then we started to appreciate it. And so I think there's a question about how much expansion is there, how easy is it to do that. I mean, if you look at the heads of agreement, it was really nice and said, you know, any party can basically do whatever it wants as long as it doesn't adversely impact the other parties. That's really nice in a heads of agreement, but, you know, when you start get to the nitty-gritty, you know, do you have exactly those rights? How are those rights going to be codified and protected, and the costs, et cetera, et cetera? So in that context, you know, we're not engineers. We have no independent view of the costs of 42 versus 48, the cost-benefit analysis. We do know, and it's apparent from the governor's AKLNG project review, that there is some work that has happened with numbers, and it's not just the theoretical, oh, you know, we would like 48 because it sounds nice. You know, there's some really specific numbers in terms of the payback period and so on and so forth. And so, you know, when we're looking at this question, I think it's very positive that the project has decided to put on the extra cost. I know that this is something that the previous administration felt very strongly about as well, in terms of the interest to examine the case for a 48-inch pipe. And I think that we'll all have to wait and see what the pros and cons commercially are to get there. And I don't have an answer to that, because if I did, we would all save $30 million of the additional pre-feed costs. I do want to say one thing, though, about you asked about the AOGCC and the Prudhoe Bay sort of decision and the different parties there. And I think, again, you know, when I look at the supply for the gas, as we talked in our Anchorage sort of LNG project review and our seminar, is, you know, you ultimately have one party, ExxonMobil, that has a much bigger chunk of Point Thompson, and ConocoPhillips has a much smaller exposure to Point Thompson relative to what they have in Prudhoe Bay. And so, you know, that's a big question in terms of how do you balance these things, how much flexibility do you want to offer to Prudhoe Bay. You know, do you want them to be able to go all the way to 4.1 or 3.6? So I think what you're seeing is partly, you know, an effort to make two streams of gas sort of be balanced over time in a way that everyone is happy with. And so that's how I would read that, as part of these negotiations of making sure that you come up with a stream of gas that both parties that are sort of more exposed to Point Thompson or less exposed to Point Thompson, they feel comfortable about these two fields coming together and producing a steady stream of gas. So that's the context in which I would think about, is that different parties see the contribution of the two fields and the flexibility that should come from each field. They see them differently because they have different ownership positions in those assets. So I don't know that it presents a huge risk for the project or anything like that. I don't look at that and say, oh, no, or anything. It's just something that will come naturally as part of the negotiation process. And at least if I'm remembering correctly from the AOGCC ruling, the finding was that either of those two production scenarios would not have a huge difference in terms of the ultimate resource recovery. Again, I'm just quoting by memory, but I think that was – so I don't see that decision as having a huge impact on the amount of gas that will be produced. It's more about the timing and the costs and all that.
Thank you, Mr. Cordero.
Representative Aizman. Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So since we've been asked to take care of it, to add this employee for $800,000, and we're in the NBA finals, should we not be looking at the qualifications of everybody who's going to be on this project, and, you know, on AGDC, Department of Revenue, Department of Natural Resources, and Law? I mean, why would we just focus on one position?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense to examine to go with the NBA analogy, who you're fielding, right? I think it makes a lot of sense to look at all the people that the state team is putting forward from AGVC, to the departments, everyone who's involved in this process. I think it makes sense to make sure that you have the best people possible. The only comment I had on the famously $800,000 salary is that, you know, when I look at that number and I know what some of my former clients make, I don't think that this is an outrageous number as a ceiling. I mean, you probably don't want to just go give that money to the first guy that applies. I hope so. I hope not. If you are, then maybe we can take a brief at ease and I can put in my resume. But, you know, I think that that's probably a fair salary in terms of where, and I think the explanation that the Commissioner for Natural Resources gave, which is that, you know, you can't give these guys stock options, you can't give these guys bonuses, you kind of have to go for a higher base salary in order to be able to attract them up here. And I think that those are fair points. Again, I don't know if the specific individual you'll find is worth this amount of money, but I think, you know, to play at this level, these are the kind of salaries that you may be expected to offer. And again, I have no, I don't think that you should sort of ignore everyone else and just focus on this poor guy, poor but well-paid guy, and kind of ignore everyone else. I think you should be looking across the board at who the team is and make sure that you have the best people for the job. You know, I think the principle that the project management team said, you know, the best people play, I think that's a pretty good principle for the state to have as well.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilson.
So I want to follow up on another comment you made about Alaska being in this project. I want to make sure that we're not telling private industry that they should expect more issues when they're trying to permit than if they become partners of the state of Alaska. So I don't think that's what you meant, that permitting would be easier or whatever the state required just because we're a partner versus if some private industry came in and just wanted to go through the process.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. To clarify, we didn't make any statements about permitting. I think others may have. But I think certainly on that front, while, you know, the state has certain interests, obviously, and there are certain things that having the sovereign involved can make happen more easily, one of the challenges of this project is it's really, really important also to differentiate between the sovereign's role as regulator, as dispassionate regulator, and the sovereign's role as resource owner with a commercial interest. And, you know, things have been put into place already in the organizational structure to try to make that division clear, and that's part of the division between AGDC and DNR, for instance. And obviously, even more so with other more directly regulatory agencies like AOGCC, for instance, right? So those divisions are important because it's important in any arrangement like this for the regulatory functions of the state to be kept separate from the commercial interests of the state.
Thank you. And I just have one last question, Mr. Chair. Well, and I just wanted to make sure we weren't sending a message I don't think we meant to. You know, hopefully our permitting is right on and quick, no matter who the entity is. So this is kind of, I'm just using your professional opinion on this last question. And I'm not trying to set you up. It's just a question that's been in my mind the whole time. So what advantage would there have been for the administration to bring this forward now versus in May when that's when we've heard kind of everything started going south? You know, we were in special session in May and June of this year, sadly enough. So what would have been the advantages to doing it now versus then when right now we're kind of up against this timeline that we wouldn't have been then, and understood a little bit more about the transition, a little bit about, you know, who's doing, you know, all this. So what would have been the advantage to do it now versus earlier? And would you have done it earlier if it had been you versus now? And it's just your professional opinion. There's no right or wrong answer.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I would simply say it takes time to do the analysis. You know, you may start, you know, a new administration came in at the start of this, you know, end of last year, right, had a legislative session to get through as well as getting their heads across the enormous complexities of this project. You may come in questioning some aspects and not others. You may, you know, dig and try to get more detail. You also have, in any new administration, you know, the early struggles of trying to figure out who's doing what and what the appropriate structure is and what interests are represented. And it takes time to figure all those things out. And then once you've figured all those things out, if you're approaching this from an analytical and dispassionate perspective, it takes time to staff up and get the consultants and people, you know, the internal resources to focus on this and think about what are the available options to you. So I don't look at this and think, oh, we could have done this, you know. The critical time was always this point. This was always the point when, under the agreements last year, there was going to have to be a decision on whether we signed an FTSA or we didn't. And in that sense, this timing is quite logical. It would be nice if we could be here and also be looking at a whole bunch of other agreements, but, you know, it's also completely understandable that those things take time and have intractable issues involved with them. We understand that as well.
I appreciate it. Mr. Chair, maybe that's a question to Pat Pitney, because it's my understanding that the decision was made, and we've been in a transition ever since. And I think for us it would have been nicer, before we closed the budget out for this last year, that money would have been allocated at that point versus now adding more to what we already passed. Thank you very much.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here for the last several years. The one thing I just wanted to say is that there's a lot of unanswered questions that have come up over Senate Bill 138, and I know a lot of those questions you had in your old documents here. And the information that you've been providing has been not inconsistent, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate these questions here, because these are questions that we should find out from the appropriate agencies. I had two questions, actually. Just the first one is dealing with the money. The new money, I think, will be something of an issue for the committees to discuss. There might be a committee substitute, but the changes in the work plan that now cost more money, so that some of the feed will go into pre-feed. It was just your testimony to the chair that generally that's something that is looked favorably upon to reduce risk. Can you just comment on that?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, I would, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, I would say that the way I interpret it is that, you know, you see risks and you want to bring that work forward to make sure that you grapple with those risks. So I don't see it as a favorable thing that you need to do more work, because it means you have more issues that we're dealing with. So that in itself I don't think is a favorable thing. What I would say is favorable is that that would give us comfort that if you then move to the feed stage, you have brought some of these issues forward, and therefore at that point you're making a much better decision, because you're more comfortable with your ability to manage the risks that you foresaw. That's how I would phrase it. My apologies if I said it differently before, but that's, I think, how I would phrase it.
That sounds great. My question actually goes to the second bullet dealing with expansions, and we've discussed a lot about expansions and having a third-party pipeline company versus, I guess, a third-party pipeline company versus like a producer-owned pipeline company, and the fact that a third party wants to expand, and that's a great benefit for the state of Alaska, and I agree with that. If the state, the question, I guess, AGDC, I guess, under what conditions would the state of Alaska or AGDC not wish to pursue expansions? I just can't conceivably think of a time in which that would be. To whoever.
Look, I'll take a crack at that. And I don't think, you know, there isn't a specific scenario we're thinking of on that front. I think we included that bullet point in response to a couple of things, but including, you know, in both this committee and the Senate equivalent, a question was asked when AGDC was here about, you know, what would future expansions look like, and how that will be managed, and will AGDC have that capacity? And, you know, again, we haven't had a chance to talk to AGDC to go over some of this, and we would very much like to. At the time, we were concerned to hear a response that said, you know, this will look a lot like TAPS. There will be a project company, and all that will be the responsibility and the function of the project company. And I think if you asked us, we would say we were very clear in the discussion last year that the intention all around in negotiating the heads of agreement was this idea, right, of project within a project, pipe within a pipe, that we, any of us individually, can do things in our interests independent of the others, and that was particularly clear in the expansion principles under the heads of agreement, which is to say any party wants to expand, provided it doesn't negatively impact the others, can pursue an expansion. But taking that approach means that you're not relying on everyone agreeing on this together and everyone thinking that this is in all of their interests and unanimity at the voting committee that says, yeah, the project company can go ahead and do this. This relies on what we have an entity that wants to pursue this and wants to pursue this aggressively and has all of the both technical and commercial capability required to make that case, to figure out what the new resource base is, to be out there figuring out what the tariff needs to be, and you know what level of resource is required to make this economic, and how you build that commercial case, and how you then go ahead and do that, bearing in mind that your other partners aren't necessarily going to want to do it with you. And that's we just want to make sure that that tension is clear, and that moving forward, everyone involved in this across the entire breadth of the state apparatus that's moving this forward is thinking in those terms and thinking in those terms now.
Yes, follow up?
Yeah. Follow up,
Representative. So again, why couldn't the state just be, I mean, why would the state absent TransCanada, why wouldn't that be a more effective way to pursue expansions? I mean, it seems like having a third party in that particular case, there might be disagreements between TransCanada and the state in pursuing, and I think under the HOA it actually spells out the ways in which an expansion would happen if the state wanted it but TC didn't.
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, in lots of ways I think we'd agree with you, and I think we'd look back over the last 2 years and say, well, look, the last 2 years were a chance to test some of those assumptions of, you know, by bringing in an independent company, was that a move that meant we had someone that was perfectly aligned with us on all these issues, or did we actually sometimes disagree and sometimes have to negotiate against each other, and what was that a net benefit or a net positive? And, you know, lots of the details of that are confidential and we'll never know. But what we can say looking forward is that we do need to have that capability. And whether that capability existed or not under the previous arrangement, we may never know, but we do know that it takes a lot to have that capability, and we need to be thinking about what's involved in having that capability now. The fact that we can all agree that we want it doesn't make it so. We need to plan now to make sure that we have it.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Next we have Representative Guerra, followed by Gaddis and Sadler.
Thank you. I was speaking to somebody, and we recalled, but correct me if we're wrong, that in the past you'd said one of the problems with TransCanada owning 25% of stuff that we don't own any of, the line, the GTP, there are going to be areas where we have no access to information, and that presents some problem. And that's one of the things we really haven't talked about very much. I don't want a long answer, but can you just give us an example as briefly as you can of like some area where that would be a problem for us not having access to information if they were 25% owners of some of the major infrastructure?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, we can't speak on specifics because we're not on the project team, so I can't tell you that I have requested information and how it's been responded. But I can see, especially with layers of confidentiality, that as the project sponsor, you know, as Janik says, you'd like to know that nitty-gritty decisions are being made with expansion in mind, and you want to get access to some of the technical information and checking that. And I can see how that flow back to either AGDC or the departments may not be seamless. Again, I have no firsthand experience of that, but I can, you know, I've worked in enough organizations where non-confidential information is hard to come by, and it's not hard for me to imagine that once you add three or four layers of confidentiality, it gets harder and harder to access that information, access it in a timely way, maybe ahead of votes or ahead of decision points. So that's how I would imagine it.
I would add to that, and for the record, Janik, may I, only one thing, which is when you had Deputy Commissioner Rutherford and Dickon Potterville here, they did give one example, I think, of that, specifically in the context of existing arrangements with TransCanada, and that was about byproduct disposal. And so the question of, you know, particularly, obviously, a big portion of the function of the gas treatment facility is removal of CO2 and its eventual disposal. And how all that works and how the economics of that work, you know, is obviously a complex issue that can allows all sorts of costs to be allocated in all sorts of places. And one can quite easily see that from the state's perspective, there are particular interests in seeing that handled particular ways, and that if one doesn't have visibility into how that's being handled and has neither transparency and visibility nor direct control over voting, that that creates some issues.
Thanks. I think there's, through the chair, I think there's one area everybody agrees on, which is if we left TransCanada in the project and the project eventually didn't go forward, it costs us more to have them in the project than to buy them out. So that's not anything we need to follow up on.
Representative Garrett.
Through the chair, yeah. The flip side is you would agree that the lower the financing costs are for the state compared to TransCanada, the greater the revenue is for us by buying them out over the long term if the project succeeds. That's fair?
Yeah. We agree.
We agree. And then what First Southwest said on page 36 of the Black and Veatch report, which you said you've relied on their information, is that if state financing, quote-unquote, would result in a materially lower interest cost to the state than under the TransCanada agreement. And you have any disagreement with that?
Representative Guthrie, the chair, I don't think we disagree with that statement as it stands. We simply would like to, you know, as I think we did want to put some of those numbers in context and say that from a precautionary perspective, one should look at these things and think about the numbers at the higher end of the spectrum of some of the things that were presented rather than the lower.
If I could add, Mr. Chair, Representative Guerra, through the chair, it depends on what you mean by material, right? I mean, if materially is interpreted as, you know, 2-3 percentage points delta, I think that's it's hard to see that, right? We think the spread that we talked about is much more reasonable at the higher end of the credit rating or lower end of the credit rating.
Go ahead, Representative Garrett.
Chair. Yeah, if we go to page 5 of your presentation. And, you know, I'm not going to pretend that I know which one of those bar graphs is the right one. But when Ms. Podoval testified, she testified that the 5.5% financing rate, which she calculated would raise us maybe an extra $130 million a year, that rate is, that's about where we would be if we were at our historically worst credit rating that we've ever had in the state. You recall that testimony?
We do, Representative Garrett, yes.
And I don't expect you to tell me, nobody knows which of these bar graphs is the right number, but at the worst financing level we ever were in the state with current market conditions, she said it's $130 million extra a year. If we get our fiscal house in order, hopefully by before 2017, the annual additional revenue could be higher than that. It could be lower than that. Any of those are reasonable assumptions, and we'll know more as time passes. Is that correct?
Representative Garrett, through the chair, I'd like to actually answer with not a yes or no question.
Okay.
Let me give you a slight longer answer. For the record, Nikos Tsafos, and I realize the irony of having a Greek tell you about state finances. So please bear with me. And I say that because, you know, Greece's credit rating had never been as bad until it was, you know. So these are unknown things. I did want to make the one comment about the 5.5.
You warned us not to go there, though.
That's why I'm here. This is what the future looks like. Don't go down this path. I did want to make one comment. So the 5.5 here is essentially, if you look at this chart from First Southwest, you know, if you were to issue everything overnight, which you won't, and if you were to have this kind of downgrade, you know, you would get close to that 5.5. But having said that, this 5.5, the 130 million, compares it to the baseline tariff from TransCanada, not adjusted for the equity tracker, not adjusted for the tracker. So what I mean by that is that this is comparing 5.5, which is sort of, you can say, today's conditions, against 6.8, which is the conditions of December 2013. In today's conditions, the tariff from TransCanada is more like 5.8 in the operational phase. So that's why, even if you say it's going to be 5.5, you're really talking about 5.5 versus 5.8 or 6, which is the TransCanada number. So the delta is much smaller than that. So that's why it's a little bit messy when you think about, because you're sort of comparing time and interest rates. When you look at the delta, which is really 5.3 versus 5.8, that's 50 basis point delta. In 50 basis point delta, you're a lot closer in this chart at the 60 million chart. So again, it's not, I mean, I would love to have an extra $60 million a year, right? So it's not, we're not trying to say it's good or bad. We're just trying to contextualize that.
And I'd add only one thing, which is actually not about the substance, but just to clarify one thing for the record, which is that over the last several days, there were, in fact, two different presentations, right? There was the sort of state finance team of Lazard, the First Southwest, Greengate, that talked about historical credit ratings and A-minus being the worst that the state has had, and Black & Veatch presenting this analysis. And I think Black & Veatch were actually very clear to say, you know, if you want to know about specific interest rates, refer you to the state finance team. Black & Veatch just presents these numbers as a range of outcomes. And I think they might want that on the record, so I just wanted to put that clarification there.
Thank you. And through the chair.
Go right ahead, Representative Garrett.
I'm not going to pin you down on any of these outcomes, but I mean, is it fair to say this is a range of reasonable potential outcomes and we just don't know?
Representative Garrett, I think that's a reasonable statement. I think particularly given that we've started from the premise that there is no circumstance under which the state is viewing this purely financially worse off in a no TC case, that this is a random variable that goes from zero to some positive number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just that, that there was some focus on the $100 to $130 million range, and I just wanted to make clear that, well, what your views were. So thanks.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Next, we have Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question is back to the well-paid $840,000 a year person. But my bigger question is this: for a gas marketer, are we ahead of ourselves in hiring one now, or do we have that opportunity, quite frankly, when our next session opens, and certainly after December 4th when we know we have gas to market?
Representative Gaddis, through the chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos. I struggle a little bit with that question because, you know, I don't know the material difference between approving this now or approving this in a few months. I would answer, if I could, in a slightly broader way, which is that right now is the time that you need a gas marketer, in the sense that at least in the conversations last year with SB 138, and I believe the current administration views it this way, you know, the decision to take royalty in kind is premised on the state being comfortable that it will know what to do with this gas once it has it. And I think to gain that comfort, you need people that have expertise and can assess the risks to the state of taking possession of this gas. At last year, there was a big emphasis on the state possibly negotiating joint venture agreements with individual partners in the project and have and marketing the gas jointly with them, for instance, and having the partners make offers to the state to market their gas. So all these things are eventualities that are factoring in the decision to take the gas in kind, and it's part of the discussion. So I think it is important to have a person there. Now, I can't tell you that I know exactly where the negotiations are to tell you the difference of appropriating the money now or appropriating the money in a few months. What I can tell you in my experience is that from the time you appropriate the money until the first day that this person starts, it usually takes a while, right? So I would say, you know, if this money, again, I'm not quite sure if we're thinking about the normal budget, if it's appropriate in April, then you can call the headhunters in May, and then, you know, you get into the summer, no one wants to come for interviews. Again, I'm talking about very nitty-gritty things. And so that's the kind of stuff that I would think about is, you know, do you sort of inadvertently delay the start that this person would actually be able to join the gas team and help with the negotiations? That's how I would think about it. Again, just brainstorming with you.
Right, and thank you. Quite frankly, that was the question. You answered my question, whether we have time to wait or whether it stalls something, so I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. Next, we have Representative Sadler.
Thank you. A comment, then a question. I want to make sure we don't misrepresent the financials here in slide 5. This does not show, it's not accurate to say that there is 360 up to 360 more million dollars somehow as a net benefit to the state by having TransCanada out. It's, as the slide says on the top, it is a wash. Given the consideration of the net present value, you buy that $360 million in additional cash flow later by the upfront investment of $2 billion upfront. So this is not an extra profit. This is a wash. So just for the record there. My question is, I'm sorry, sir. Excuse me?
Could we have you respond to that,
yeah,
please?
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
Do you want
to? That's a precedent.
Representative Sadler, through the chair. If one thinks about this in net present value terms, it's not a large net present value. I think one can certainly say that it's, you know, at a 10% discount rate, Black & Veatch show it as being $0 billion in their report. I think it's actually about $30 million, for instance, if you actually get down to the rounding error that's taken out of that. I think, you know, precisely because one can have so many arguments right about what are appropriate discount rates to use, I think that's useful in showing that, you know, this isn't some overwhelming piece of value that the state was missing out on if it went down the TransCanada route for strategic reasons. I think it's more useful in being able to compare apples to apples, and I really appreciate that Black & Veatch included this chart to enable this comparison, to say, well, there is a direct comparison here, right, which is, imagine we fully funded the replacement of TransCanada through debt. What does this look like? And then you're not in the world of this 360. You're somewhere on this continuum. And I think, you know, for instance, Representative Garra's characterization that at 5.5% financing, you're at 130, bearing in mind the proviso that Mr. Safos gave that said, well, even that is actually assuming a bigger spread than we see at the moment, and maybe you're further down. As we said, we don't know where we are exactly on this spectrum. This gives a range of values. There is some value between zero and a positive amount. We would say is probably, you know, between zero and 100 and We are happiest, I think, with the right-hand side of this chart in terms of thinking about what that benefit might be, bearing in mind that there could be other financing strategies that the state is considering that move you further to the left. There is likely some positive benefit in annual cash flows that comes from the state doing this financing on its own. Our overall viewpoint is simply to say that in the overall scheme of things, that by itself, absent strategic considerations, is not dispositive.
Representative Sadler.
Well, thank you. So I think that does clarify it somewhat, that it's not the full $360 million difference. It's not 300, it's somewhat less than 130, and you're not exactly sure. Well, so good. I appreciate that clarification for myself and other people. So my question is, actually I've got two. My first one is on slide 3. There's a reference to the non-visibility of information that's been going on. Let's find slide 3.
Last bullet of the big chunk.
Okay, thank you. Non-visibility. And on slide 7, there's a reference to unclear decision-making and division of labor in the state of Alaska. So my question is this unusual to have this unclear decision-making and non-visibility, and does that confusion have any consequences to the likelihood of success to the project? That's my first question. Or is this, like I say, is this usual in large projects like this, or is it unusual?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, I would say as a blanket statement, confusion does not help the advancement of a project, right? So I think when you have people that don't quite know who's in charge, how they interact with one another. What we can't speak to is, you know, the extent of that. You know, we're not in this organization. I can't tell you, you know, who I send emails to and how quickly I get responses and whether I can get meetings and information. I don't know that. But I would say, you know, is it typical for this kind of mega project? I would say it's unlikely to be typical of successful mega project. I mean, it's hard to sort of stumble your way into a $55 billion project, right? You need to get your act together to be able to play at this level and to be able to do this. So I don't think I'm not speaking for the specific circumstances of the state, but I'm saying when you have an organization that is has decision-making and informational sort of barriers, you know, that always gets in the way of getting stuff done. And this is true for any endeavor, and it's particularly true when you're trying to do one of the hardest and most complicated infrastructure projects in the history of the world.
Okay, and my second question then, if I can, actually, yes. Well, and there's a question I've tried to get answered a couple different ways from a couple different folks, and that's, we do understand the financial calculations. I think by this time of the week we understand that. But I'm still trying to get some idea about the intangibles. Is it possible to quantify the benefit of TransCanada in this project, absence of the financials, whether that's in terms of, I think you put in your original slides, as continuity and et cetera, et cetera. You know, we can make our own subjective judgments, but is there a way to weigh it or to quantify the benefit of having TransCanada in this project?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think it's possible. I would not attach a great deal of certainty to these numbers. I mean, if you ask, like, I think there are ways to do it. There, you can attach probabilities of a more expensive project or a, you know, slower development. I mean, there's math you can do, but I think those would be purely conjecture rather than actually saying, oh, I know that if we had TransCanada in here, the project would be done 6 months earlier. I think that would be pure conjecture.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, and for the record, Janik Mayer. I'd add to that solely that, and this doesn't quite address the question of quantitatively, you know, quantifying some of these elements, but, you know, you look at this list, and there are some key things on there that we actually successfully got the benefit of, right, particularly in terms of continuity, momentum, a geodissolution, you know, having TC at the table while a bunch of negotiations were going on. And I think one can look at that and look back on the last year and a half and think that that was a very good decision at the time, and that, you know, we simply reached a different point in the relationship. And I think that's important to bear in mind.
We're developing a lot of information, and there's, like I say, this kind of subjective weighing. It's just nice to know if we can bring some precision and the metrics to this big, big decision. Thanks, sir.
I think we can quantify that should we not terminate TransCanada, they intend to vote no on December 4th, which ends the project completely, and I think we can quantify that this might not be to the best advantage of the state with a project that might end up being successful.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I could just add one more thing, Nikos Tsafos, for the record, just to, Janik said something and it kind of just clicked with me. You know, when you think about the benefits that TransCanada brought to the table in terms of their GIA and experience and continuity and all that, you know, if I think of it again, this is a very crude way, but essentially, you know, the interest part of what you're paying TransCanada is around $3 million, I think, is what Black & Veatch has mentioned. So that's, you know, you think about what you got versus what you paid, and if you think about, you know, some of the appropriations in front of you, you know, this is, you know, you got some expertise out of it. Now, I can't tell you exactly what those numbers would have looked like absent TransCanada, right? But that's sort of, you know, some of the ways in which you could possibly think about what you got versus what you paid.
Thank you. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I have lots of questions, but I think I'm going to leave my question to with your last statement, that if TransCanada is still in the game and they get to vote on December 4th, they vote no. I don't think I'm going to ask any more questions beyond that statement. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guttenberg. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question gets back to the idea of forcing gas to the project, whether or not the partner is involved in the ownership of the project, and setting a December deadline for those commitments. Is that a feasible expectation on the part of the state? And is it in our best interest to demand those kind of agreements at this stage in the project?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, Nikos Tsafos, for the record, the question on feasibility is easier to answer because it's easier for me to say I have no idea, because I don't know how far the two sides are in terms of what the state is requesting and what the producers are willing to offer. All I have is what you have, which is three letters from three oil companies saying that subject to A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, we are willing to talk to you and sign an agreement. So I don't really know how close the two sides are, how what exactly the terms are. So I don't know if that's feasible because I just don't know how much work needs to be done. So let me then focus more on your second question, which is it desirable? And I would like to answer that in a couple of ways. I think that I can certainly see a circumstance where if one or more of the parties thinks that this is not for them, that one of the solutions you may explore is to buy their gas, for example, at the wellhead. I think that when I look at projects of LNG around the world, it's fairly common for companies to adjust their exposure to the project as they learn more about the project and as they do a thorough assessment of how big of a piece of the project they want. So the process itself of exploring sort of a different structure to solve the non-commitment of a party, I think that process makes sense. You see that around the world. You've seen this in many projects. What I would say concerns us a little bit at this stage is making too much of a commitment up front, because you just don't really have a lot of information. And the broad our broad sort of approach to this has always been, if ExxonMobil is willing to sell you some gas at the wellhead, it's probably at a price that you shouldn't buy it, right? That's been sort of our instinct, right? Which is that, you know, this is a commercial transaction, and if they, you know, if they're willing to sell you the gas, for example, at, you know, Henry Hub, I'm just making this up, it means because they don't think they can make more than that by participating in the project, which therefore means that probably you're not going to be able to make more than that by doing the project. So what I would like to really understand, and I have zero knowledge and visibility on this particular issue, I'd like to understand how specific those discussions are and how exactly those terms are playing out. Because if you try to, quote-unquote, lock yourself in a deal, you know, you could find yourself with liabilities, whether these are firm liabilities or contingent, or, you know, I have no idea what is being negotiated. You know, that could be a problem. The last thing I would say is, I think it worries us a little bit to give the companies a way out, right? In the sense that you're trying to do a very complicated project. And if I were in the room, I don't want half the folks to be thinking, "Oh, you know, whatever. We're just going to get out of this. You know, it's okay." So you're not spending time solving the issues. You're kind of designing your exit strategy. And I think how that plays out, I have no idea because I'm not in the room. But once you put that on the table, you know, I mean, you heard from Vincent Lee yesterday in TransCanada. He said, you know, once people thought that we were out, you know, no one could work our issue. It was harder for them to get people to spend time on their issues. And so I would flip that a little bit. Once people start thinking that, oh, I may have a way out, you know, you start having some muddling of the negotiations and the progress in the project. So, you know, I think that where you end up, which is possibly entering into these agreements, that might happen. I'm not quite sure that I'm sold on the necessity of doing this today rather than over time. That would be my gut feeling, and without having a ton of visibility into the specifics.
If I could just follow up on
follow
that
up,
point.
Representative Munoz.
Could that requirement or that demand jeopardize the project and the momentum of the project to date?
Representative Munoz.
What did you do?
Through the chair.
You can charge us for that.
Is this? I think it's still working.
It's still working. Fine.
Okay. Resident Munoz to the chair, your follow-up actually relates very nicely to something I was about to add to Nikos's response otherwise, which is to say, I think there's one, you know, I agree very strongly with everything Nikos just said. I have one further thought to add, which is that we've talked, in talking about the Trans-Canada issue, about the idea of a success leg versus a failure leg. Right, and what the costs of that deal look like in the success case versus the failure case. And fundamentally, when we talk about withdrawal agreements, we are talking about some iteration of the failure case. Not necessarily the failure case of any project, but the failure case of the project as it's currently designed. Right? And that's fine. There are aspects of the failure case we need to think about and plan for. But everyone involved in this, the state, the companies, all have limited time and limited resources. And it's really easy to, you know, get into thinking about these entities as though, oh my God, you know, ExxonMobil, BP, et cetera, you know, they must have so many people to throw at this that anything we ask from them, they must be able to figure out and get back to us. But, you know, the reality is everyone involved in this process has limited time and limited resources and limited bandwidth to particular problems that they can focus on. And if you focus on one set of problems, there are another set of problems you aren't focusing on, right? And so to the extent that what one is trying to do is advance further down the success leg of what this project might look like and focus on advancing all of the difficult agreements one needs to advance, all of the disagreements one needs to overcome to get to the project as it's envisioned under the heads of agreement, then, you know, the work that goes into thinking about withdrawal agreements, whether that's important or not, and people can make their own minds about that, is work that is fundamentally taking away from the work to advance down the success leg.
Okay, and then just to kind of summarize too, could you kind of give your closing thoughts on the template, the SB 138 template, and the integration with the state participating as a model? Just kind of give kind of an overview of an analysis of that model as a positive model for the state of Alaska.
Representative Munoz, through the chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos. As SB 138 and the 3 months we've spent in Juneau, I've locked up in what we call long-term memory. So I'm not going to go into the details of it. But I suspect the question you're asking is, you know, what are the merits of the state being an equity partner in this project and taking ownership of the gas and having 25% infrastructure? So if that's your question from your nodding, I think I can go on. That I can talk to. I just don't want to get into the weeds of SB 138 because thankfully I've forgotten some of them. I would say, you know, broadly speaking, there's one major challenge in developing this gas in a different way, which is that if you tax the gas at the wellhead and generate your revenue as a state in that way, the same way you do with oil, you face two fundamental challenges. The first is that you make your money in the complete opposite way that the producers make their money, right? So you maximize your value in the completely opposite way of how the producers maximize their value, or at least you're in clash in certain regards in that. The second aspect to that is that when you look at the gas value chain and how expensive this project is, there isn't a lot of value at the wellhead to tax, right? Because, again, you think about current prices, but let's go back to a slightly rosier world. Let's say it's $10 or $11 in Japan, the price that you're going to sell at. You know, if it costs you 9 or 10 to get it there, you know, you can tax that one remaining dollar as much as you like, you know, but it's just not a lot, not a lot. And so the additional challenge that you had in the sort of pre-SB 138 structure, not only is there very little value to tax, but secondly, there's absolutely no way to decide if that number to subtract from the $11 in Japan should be 8 or 9 or 10 or 11 or 5 or 6. And the reason is because TAPS, which is a pipeline you've had a lot of conflict with the producers over, is a federally regulated pipeline. This is actually a pipeline where there's very clear jurisdiction and very clear sort of tariff setting. And think about how much challenge you've had with that. Now, take a gas pipeline where the tariff is no longer $5 or $4 a barrel, but $60, and where there's no regulatory structure because FERC generally does not regulate export projects, the tariff of export projects.
So, you know, you have a ton of challenges to overcome to be able to make any money out of this thing. And so in our view, and the reason we were sort of, we liked SB 138 in what it tried to accomplish, is to say, you know what, that's just too much. Forget about that. Let's not go down this path. You know, I mean, we're getting in the analogies to work with Representative Kawasaki of marriages. I mean, it's sort of like re-entering a marriage with a 40-year horizon and thinking about just how much you argued along the way. You know, it's you don't want to do that, and the producers don't want to do that, right? And so the merit of the state taking equity is to say, look, no valuation questions. We take 25% of the gas. We take our royalty. We take our tax. We turn it into gas, and we participate in the project. And then we have our gas, you have your gas, we have our ownership of the pipe, you have your ownership of the pipe, we have our ownership of the LNG, you have your ownership of the LNG. And we don't need to get into all these big disputes. So that was the main merit of that. And it had a number of benefits in terms of, you know, I would say the biggest thing, and again, you've essentially asked me to, you know, review the 2014 legislative session for us. So I apologize for the long answer, but I'll finish with this statement, which is, you know, the biggest surprise for Janik and I as we started getting into the weeds of this and run our own economic model is that the intuition says that if you take ownership, you know, you expose yourself to more risk, right? Because that's what the intuition says. If I just step back and tax, I don't have any risk. If I take ownership, I take on more risk. And what we discovered was that because of the way that the valuation process work, you actually were better protected on the downside by taking ownership in the project. And to put it very simply is, you know, if the price is 11 and the cost is 10 and there's $1 remaining at the wellhead, if you tax that, you just get whatever the tax is times $1. But, you know, if the price in Japan goes to 10, then it's zero, right? So a 10% decline in the price of gas, you know, takes you from whatever you were to zero. So you are subjected to a much bigger swing. And that was one of the merits. And there's a ton more issues that we could get into. Obviously, I'm not trying to compress the whole session.
I'd just like to add one more thing to Nikos's last point, if I could, by way of clarification. And for the record, Janik Meyer.
Can we turn to the last slide?
Nikos's point about sort of, you know, revenue volatility and price and commodity risk, I think, is an important one. And it's an important one to just put a few qualifiers on that also come back to some of our last points here about the optimal capitalization structure for the state of Alaska, right? What Nikos says is particularly true, for instance, in a world where the state of Alaska were able to fully fund its capital commitment to EKLNG through equity, right? In that world, the state of Alaska can say, you know, we built the infrastructure, we paid for it up front, and from this point forward, we simply get revenues for our LNG, and there is no impact of, you know, leverage, if that makes sense. There's no fixed cost that we need to meet for every single MMBTU of LNG that we sell into Japan. So whether the price is $18 or the price is $6, we're going to get that $6 or that $18. And the fundamental question for us in that sense becomes, over the 20-year time horizon of this project, did we make the rate of return? You know, were prices on average over the long run high enough for us to make the rate of return that we hoped when we invested in the project? When we look at a highly levered case, and, you know, this concerns us because, you know, there's been a lot of discussion in the entire TransCanada discussion about financing this through high levels of debt, right? And it's as Nico said, it's exactly like buying your house with a, you know, 5% down, less than 5% down mortgage. It suddenly massively increases your exposure to volatility in terms of when prices go up, prices go down, in exactly the same way as Nikos was describing for the value at the wellhead model. When you do this through a lot of leverage, you also get exposed once again to those high commodity risks. And that's one of the reasons we included this up there, was to stress the point of, at this point, starting to think more broadly about the capitalization structure for this project and all the things that the state can do, whether it's through capital structure, whether it's through the LNG contracts that the state negotiates, and, you know, having, for instance, potentially a different risk tolerance than the producers have with their contracts, the ways that the state can minimize its exposure to price volatility. Thinking about that is going to get very critical as we move forward.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you guys very much. Nikos and Janik, thank you for your dedication to following this through numerous meetings in this building, and we really appreciate you bringing this to us, and I'm sure you're going to be involved for a few more days. We've already got 5 days under our belts. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, Friday, the 30th of October, we'll be meeting here in this room at 1:30 p.m. Tomorrow we have a continuation of HB 3001, and tomorrow we'll have a presentation by Steve Butt, the Senior Project Manager for ExxonMobil Development Company and the Alaska LNG Project Senior Team Member. So we'll see you all tomorrow. Thank you very much, and with that, we are adjourned.